I'm Jonathan Bastian. This week on KCRW's Life Examined, a good night's rest is widely viewed as the most important part of our day. But less than a century ago, very little was known about why we sleep and what happens to us when we do.
For millennia, sleep has been thought of as a miniature death. Either you actually do sort of die during the night, or it's a rehearsal for death. It raises the same sorts of questions. Who are we when we have no waking consciousness? What's going on in there? Where does the self go?
And later, the rise in insomnia and what to do when sleep evades us.
The relationship between sleep and psychological issues is bi-directional, so that the more anxiety you have, the worse your sleep is going to tend to be, and the worse your sleep is, the more anxiety you feel while you're awake.
Author Kenneth Miller on the evolution of sleep science from the earliest theories to our current obsession. That's all coming up on Life Examined. To say that sleep is the single most important thing we do with our time is perhaps an overstatement. But nothing contributes more to our physical, mental, and emotional well-being than a good night's rest. It's estimated we spend a third of our lives sleeping, and for most of us, that's about 8 hours a day horizontal. So not surprisingly, sleep has become a big moneymaker, from high-tech mattresses and pillows to wearables and edibles. And yet, despite all the recent studies on the restorative impact of sleep, our circadian rhythms and REM sleep, barely 100 years ago, sleep was of little interest to the scientific community. In Mapping the Darkness, author Kenneth Miller traces some of our earliest sleep habits, from hay mattresses to the electric light bulb, and spotlights some of the extraordinary work done by Nathaniel Kleitman, Eugene Azarinsky, and others, scientists whose experiments revolutionized the way we think about sleep, exploring what happens to us when we sleep, and what we can do to make ourselves sleep better. Kenneth Miller joins me now. He's an award-winning science writer and the author of Mapping the Darkness, the visionary scientist who unlocked the mysteries of sleep. Kenneth Miller, welcome to Life Examined.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I'd love to go back in time and try and understand how maybe earlier periods or peoples might have thought about what sleep was. I mean, clearly they didn't have the scientific research we have now. So, I mean, how far back could we take this conversation in terms of conceptions around sleep?
Well, you can take it very far back. I mean, you know, in pre-industrial societies, I think the most common way to think about sleep was a time when the soul or the spirit left the body and went on a journey, which could be spatial, could be a journey in time. Your soul could go speak to the ancestors. You could travel to far distant lands, anything you wanted. And sleep was a sort of a mystical thing. But what happened, and I should say that the ancient Greeks started thinking of it a bit more scientifically. They had all sorts of speculations. Aristotle theorized, because he'd observed that people got sleepy after a large meal, that sleep resulted from vapors from the stomach rising to first the brain and then to the heart, descending to the heart, which he thought of as the seat of consciousness. And those vapors would sort of sedate the heart, and that's what made you go to sleep. So, you know, a pretty scientific sounding explanation.
It's quite yes, I love not, it. It's all over the place.
Yeah.
But I think there's something really interesting here, which is that, I mean, there had to be some level of fascination into what this mysterious thing was that we did every night, right? That was kind of creative and mystical, as you said. And I'm sure, you know, we could jump to people like Freud, who then might have thought it was a place of subconscious desires. But I think there was always probably this interesting question mark over it.
Well, absolutely. And part of the thing is that for millennia, sleep has been thought of as a miniature death. Either you actually do sort of die during the night, or it's a rehearsal for death. But there's very much, it raises the same sorts of questions as what happens to us after we die. I mean, who are we when we have no waking consciousness? What's going on in there? Where does the self go? All those wonderful, deep questions.
No, I love that stuff. So then you do a really wonderful job then looking at what we would think of as kind of the early Western scientific research. And you look at some really pioneering folks who were doing this. So, you know, where would you say the investigative side of this really began? Who would you point to?
Well, I would say it began really with the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and particularly when artificial lighting became cheap and widespread. So that would really be beginning with gas lamps, but really taking off with the introduction of the electric light bulb in the 1880s. And so sleep, until that point, had been pretty much tied for most people to the rhythms of sunrise and sunset. And a few wealthy people could afford enough candles or oil lamps to stay up late and do things like party at their mansions in the countryside. But for most people, sleep was quite a regular thing that followed these natural rhythms. When the electric light bulb came along, you could have factories staying open all night. You could have people going out and seeking entertainment until the wee hours. And lo and behold, you started getting an epidemic of something that came to be called insomnia, which was chronic sleeplessness. So that was one impetus for starting to investigate what normal sleep was supposed to be and how it went wrong. The other impetus was that the new industrial economy needed people to work at certain times on different shifts and for different lengths of time. And industrial planners had to know what the capabilities of the human body and brain were in that regard. You know, how much sleep did people really need? What would happen to them if you made them sleep at different times and stuff like that? And so scientists started investigating it really in the mid to late 19th century. But for a long time, sleep was really a sideline for scientists. Psychologists, physiologists, people like that would spend part of their time looking in a sort of a random way into what made sleep work. And there was no such thing as a full-time sleep scientist until the 1920s, when a Russian immigrant named Nathaniel Kleitman decided to become the first one.
Interesting. I mean, I'm also just sitting with this incredible juxtaposition of times where for most of human civilization or just the history of man, there was no electronic lights or gas lamps. I mean, maybe there was fire lights, right? But it's so interesting just for me to think of how certain technological developments threw, in a sense, like a major wrench into natural ways that the human body had been functioning for thousands of years. And it's a topic that comes up a lot on the show, which is that, you know, evolution happens very slowly, but that we're living in this era where things have changed so quickly. I think the body is still very much trying to catch up and make sense of what we think of as these means of progress.
That is absolutely true. And one of the great debates in sleep science until fairly recently was whether there was a biological clock in there that we had to pay attention to. Kleitman himself doubted it, and much of his scientific enterprise was involved in trying to show that really we were more adaptable than people would think. But in the late 70s, scientists started discovering that there was indeed a master clock in the brain called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which every cell had its own tiny clock, and that body systems of different kinds had their own clocks, and the suprachiasmatic nucleus was in charge of coordinating all of them. When that started to come out, suddenly it became clear that, yes, we really did have to pay attention to biology. But until that point, that wasn't really clear. And I should add that even today, we don't really know what natural sleep is in human beings. There was a book called At Day's Close that was published, about 20 years ago, that revealed that in pre-industrial societies, in many cultures, it was customary to sleep in two separate shifts. And so people would go to bed, they'd sleep for a couple of hours, they would then wake up and spend an hour or two doing chores, praying, singing, having sex, visiting the neighbors, feeding the animals. Then they'd go back to sleep. These days, when we wake up in the middle of the night, we think it's an emergency. Mm. According to that scholar, Roger E. Kirk, that was something that people did naturally for a long time. And then when the Industrial Revolution came, they forgot about it. But anthropologists who've gone out to study sleep in hunter-gatherer peoples have found that they seem to average 6 to 7 hours a night, which is below our accepted minimum of 7 to 9. They don't do much napping, and they seem to get along fine. Mm. So why is that, and why can't we? So a lot of mysteries remain.
This reminds me of a very similar debate that I've been following a little bit about food. I mean, I think food and sleep are these like perennial debates, is what's the best way to eat? What's the best way to sleep? But what I've seen in really interesting research is that, you know, people are often trying to pin down what did humans eat in earlier eras such that they were healthier than us? And who knows if they even were healthier. But the answer that I seem to be finding a lot of is that humans were incredibly adaptable. They ate meat when there was meat. They ate nuts when there was nuts. They ate vegetables when there were vegetables. Like, there was not like this one answer fits all as the right one. And what I'm hearing you say is it was probably very similar, which is that humans lived all over the world with lots of different landscapes in different sets, you know, with the lighting being different on the equator than it is up in the poles, that we would have had to adapt. And adaptability, I think, is one of the big human stories.
Absolutely true. And I would say also, as humans, we have a tendency to look back to a golden age, which we have lost, a lost paradise. And that goes for sleep as well as for our diets.
Yeah.
And when you look at the history of sleep, one thing you notice is that people didn't always sleep well in the past.
Huh.
That people's bedrooms, for example, tended to be fiendishly uncomfortable. I mean, before the advent of the industrialized, standardized mattress, most people would sleep on things in Europe and North America, in any case. You would sleep on a straw-filled bag, essentially, with the sharp pieces of straw, you know, poking out at you. People's bedrooms were infested with vermin of various kinds. You'd have bed bugs, you'd have fleas.
Yeah.
You might have a tavern next door where people were riotously singing until late at night. You might be lying up anxious, not about the presentation you had to give in the morning, but whether bandits were going to be raiding your village that night. People did not necessarily sleep better than we do in the past, though perhaps taken on average, they slept in a sort of an easier way. It wasn't so much of an issue for them. You know, you expected everybody had bed bugs, everybody had straw mattresses, and so it just wasn't the kind of issue that it is today.
No, I love it. We can all be heartened by the fact that maybe humans have always struggled with sleep on some level, right? I appreciate that. Let's kind of just jump back into the timeline of some of this research. You mentioned Nathaniel Kleitman, and I know there were others, but talk to me now again about what these researchers were beginning to find in the story of sleep. What were some of the big takeaways they were looking at?
So prior to Kleitman, scientists had measured a few of sleep's basic functions. They wanted to know, you know, especially where do the rhythms of sleep come from, and what should they be, and how do they work? Kleitman comes along. And I should tell you how all this really got started, which was with a personal story. Nathaniel Kleitman was born in 1895 in what's today Moldova, the city of Chisinau, what is now, but what was then part of the Russian Empire. He survived a couple of pogroms. Chisinau pogrom was world famous for its brutality. Knew from an early age that he was going to have to get out of there, and he showed signs of great precocity as a kid. He was a brilliant kid. Mm. Knew he'd have to get out of Russia. Left Russia on a false passport because draft age, he was Jewish, and draft age Jewish males were not allowed to travel. So he got a false passport, left Russia. It turned out to be the day that World War I broke out. Went to medical school in Beirut. And when Lebanon turned against Russia in World War I, he and his fellow Russian students were taken prisoner of war. They were evacuated first to Greece, and then he lands on Ellis Island in 1915, lives for a while in the Lower East Side in poverty, and somehow gets himself into college City College, grad school at Columbia, PhD program at University of Chicago. And within a decade of landing, he starts the world's first dedicated sleep lab. Why did he go into sleep? Well, anti-Semitism was also rampant in America in the 1920s. And if you were a Jewish researcher, it was very hard to get a job in an accepted field. You would be frozen out. And so Jewish academics tended to look for new territory. Kleitman was looking for something new. His advisor handed him, at that time, the only existing textbook on sleep. It wasn't really a textbook. It was sort of a compendium of what was known to that point. Kleitman found it absolutely fascinating. He was interested in consciousness, and he thought unconsciousness, your nightly unconsciousness, would reveal something about consciousness. And he told his advisor, I want to be the first person on the planet to research sleep full time. This is going to be my thing. And so in 1925, he starts the first sleep laboratory at the University of Chicago. And Kleitman started out by trying to do a better job of things that had already been done. So for example, he took several classmates and himself, and they all stayed up for, you know, over 100 hours at a time. And Kleitman measured their body chemistry and their respiration and their pulse and their weight and everything else that other people had just done piecemeal, he did in a comprehensive way. And he started making some really great strides in figuring out how much people move during the night, how they breathe during the night, what really happened to their sleep depth, things like that. But nobody noticed. He was really, the only person on the planet doing this, and very few people thought it was important. He would engage in debates with some of the great theorists of the time. He had a high-profile debate with Ivan Pavlov, who had a theory about sleep, which was that it was a form of generalized inhibition of the brain cells reacting to repeated stimuli. And Kleitman proved that was wrong. But nobody really cared. And the way Kleitman really broke through was in 1938, he decided to do an experiment. He had been trying to change people's sleep-wake cycles to see if they could function on a non-24-hour cycle. He was doing this with himself and with several of his students. What would happen if you tried to do a sleep-wake cycle that lasted 12 hours, 48 hours, etc.? He found that nobody could adjust to it if it was too far from 24 hours, but some people could adjust to 21 hours, some people could adjust to 28 hours. And the way he measured adjustment was whether their daily body temperature fluctuations started to match their sleep-wake cycles. So normally, your body temperature varies by 1 or 2 degrees, reaches a low point in the wee hours in the morning and a high point usually in the late afternoon, early evening. Kleitman was measuring this, and he said, he could never change his own cycles. And he wondered, is it because I'm too old and my students are younger and more adaptable? Is it something else? Is it perhaps that maybe people like me are more sensitive to external stimuli, to, the cues of sunrise and sunset and the day getting cooler at night and warmer in the morning? And the only way he felt that he could find that out was to go somewhere where you were isolated from those cues. Mm. So he first, this is in the late 1930s, he first wanted to go to the Arctic Circle during the summertime when the sun never sets, but it was in the middle of the Great Depression and he found he really couldn't afford to do that. A geologist colleague said, hey, have you thought about Mammoth Cave? Mammoth Cave in Kentucky was just becoming a national park. It was getting thousands of visitors a year, but you could go to an isolated part of the cave, perhaps, and be in completely controlled conditions. And Kleitman arranged with Mammoth Cave to do that. He spent a month in Mammoth Cave with an assistant, a younger Wow. assistant, trying to see if he could change his sleep-wake cycles. Found that It was inconclusive as an experiment. He couldn't do it. His assistant could. But what happened during that month-long expedition to Mammoth Cave was a few reporters got wind of it, and it became a nationwide media sensation. Front page headlines, newsreels in movie theaters, and so forth. And when Clayton came out of the cave in 1938, he was a celebrity. And suddenly, for the first time, ordinary people were interested in sleep science.
Wow. I mean, an amazing story from where he begins and I takes the research and presumably ends as well. What were his big takeaways in terms of what he ultimately found out about sleep, and how did he kind of change the way that we thought about, you know, what is happening in the mind?
Well, Clayman himself was one of these people who lays the groundwork for others to come. I would say the vast majority of his takeaways were incorrect. Hmm. He thought that the sleep-wake cycles were really dictated by people's will and by their habits. And therefore, he thought it was governed by the cerebral cortex, which is, you know, in charge of that sort of thing. And since human beings have the most advanced cerebral cortexes, you know, they also slept in a more consolidated. It was all baloney, but it seemed to make sense at the time. But what Clayton really proved to people was that sleep was really important, really worth thinking about. But it took really a while before it caught on. And what made it catch on was that in the early 1950s, Clayton had a student named Eugene Asarinsky, a physiology student. Asarinsky was from Brooklyn. He'd had a really rough upbringing. His father was a card shark who neglected him, and Asarinsky really had a chip on his shoulder, but he's absolutely brilliant. He came to work as Clayton's lab student and lab assistant and had to come up with something for his PhD thesis. And Clayton was getting interested in eye movements during sleep at that time. And he said, well, Asarinsky, why don't you watch people's eye movements and see what happens. Asarinsky eventually came up with a plan to do an experiment where, for the first time in history, really, he would watch people's eyes throughout the night and also measure their brain waves at the same time. Because by then, you had a machine available called a polygraph, which could measure your electroencephalogram, your brain waves, at the same time as it measured your muscle impulses. So it could measure the muscle impulses of the eyes as they moved around. So he wouldn't have to just stare at people's eyes all night. He actually had a machine that would record what was happening. Asarinsky started with his 8-year-old son, Armand. And when he recorded Armand's eye movements and brain waves throughout the night in the early 1950s, he found something really weird, which was that periodically, Armand's eyes would start jerking back and forth as if he was watching a tennis game or something. And at the same time, his brain waves would suddenly look like he was fully alert, like he was awake. But when Asarinsky went out to check on him, he was clearly asleep. He would say, Armand, and Armand wouldn't respond. So something really strange was going on. Asarinsky then started testing this on other people. He found that it happened to everybody. And he called this period the rapid eye movement period. And he published a paper in 1953 with Clayton announcing the discovery of this strange sleep period, which they really couldn't explain, but which seemed to indicate that the sleeping brain was a lot more active than anybody had thought. But Asarinsky got along so badly with Clayton that he left sleep science really in a huff before that paper was even published. He went off, he became a physiologist studying animal respiration, later came back to sleep science, but didn't make much of a mark. Right around that time, Clayton had another student, a medical student named William Dement, and William Dement volunteered to help out in Asarinsky's lab because Dement wanted to be a psychiatrist, and he was a follower of Sigmund Freud. Hmm. He was very, very fascinated with Freud. He was a devout Freudian, and Freud said, dreams are the royal road to the unconscious.
Right.
Now, REM sleep, REM sleep as we call it, rapid eye movement sleep, Asarinsky had found seem to be connected with dreams. When he woke people up during REM sleep, usually they said they'd been dreaming. When he woke them up during other sleep stages, they seldom said they would have been dreaming. So de Mentz said, REM sleep is dream sleep, and it happens regularly throughout the night. Why would that be? Well, it may be supporting one of Freud's theories, which is that dreams are a safety valve for unconscious desires that would otherwise break through into consciousness and cause psychosis. Hmm. And so de Mentz's idea was that if we can figure out what REM sleep is all about, we'll understand dreams, and it can help us understand the human psyche. So after Ostrinsky left, de Mentz took over those experiments, and de Mentz started measuring REM sleep and other sleep stages very, very carefully and very, very thoroughly, and much more so than Ostrinsky had ever done. And he found fascinating things, that REM sleep happened on average every 90 minutes throughout the night, that you had to go through stages of successive sleep depth to get there. You know, you would go through stages 1 through 4, stage 4 being the deepest sleep, now known as slow wave sleep, because your brain waves move in slow coordinated waves. And then you would bounce back up to stage 1, and suddenly your eyes would start moving, and that kind of stage 1 was REM sleep. He found that during REM sleep, people's eyes move back and forth, he thought, following the action of the dream, all sorts of interesting stuff. He also decided to start trying to deprive people of REM sleep and see what happened. He was expecting that they would develop psychosis. They didn't, but he discovered that other things happened. They became more anxious. They became more excitable. They also gained a little weight. They found it harder to focus. So, you know, he's finding all sorts of clues about what REM might mean. All this stuff started to get other scientists really interested in sleep for the first time. And another scientist in France, Michel Jouvet, was doing experiments and found that during REM sleep, he was working on cats. During REM sleep, cats actually became paralyzed. Their muscles went completely slack, a state called muscle atonia. And Jouvet wondered what this meant, and so he found that that REM sleep was originated in a part of the brainstem called the pons, a very, very primitive part of the brainstem. And so it must be something very basic to our evolution. When he destroyed that part of the pons, cats started acting out their dreams. Hmm. And you know, which is something that's quite dangerous. You think about it, if you're dreaming and you're running around the room, you're going to bump into something or fall off a cliff. This was another great clue of what REM might mean. And as Jouvet and de Mentz were publishing these things, other scientists started getting interested in sleep. And by the early 1960s, suddenly sleep was really a hot topic. And the more people learned about it, the more they learned about how it was directly connected to various aspects of human health, mental, physical, cognitive, emotional, etc.
And if you're just joining us, my guest this hour is Kenneth Miller. He's the author of the new book, Mapping the Darkness: The Visionary Scientist Who Unlocked the Mysteries of Sleep. We'll be back with Kenneth Miller for part 2 after this short break. And a reminder that you can connect with me directly on Instagram. I'm at Jonathan W. Bastian, or you can find the show on Facebook. There's a link at kcrw.com/lifeexamined. We'll be back after this short break. Stay close.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Jonathan Bastian, back with Life Examined on KCRW, and my guest, Kenneth Miller, writer and author of Mapping the Darkness: The Visionary Scientist Who Unlocked the Mysteries of Sleep. We just heard about two of the earliest sleep pioneers, Kleitman and Azarinsky, whose discovery of REM sleep revealed how active the brain becomes during sleep. So how essential is sleep to the health of our brains? Could insufficient sleep predispose us to Parkinson's, dementia, or Alzheimer's? And some tips for getting your Z's, the best remedies for a good night's sleep. So let's jump into kind of what we know now. I mean, there are so many fascinating stories that you've told about the history of this. But when you then began to kind of, you know, sift through this stuff to paint a picture of what we know now about sleep, and I know this is probably not a super easy question to answer. Like, how could you describe where the research is at now in terms of what sleep is, why it's so essential to us?
So sleep, which was once thought to be a very simple phenomenon, was once thought to be a miniature death, was once thought to be, lack of blood flow in the brain, turns out to be incredibly complex, incredibly complex. It is triggered and maintained by this just dizzying feedback loop of different brain regions communicating with each other through a cascade of different neurotransmitters and stuff like that. But what we know is that it is essential to things like memory formation and thus to learning. It's also the case that during sleep, it was discovered just about 10 years ago that there's a system in your brain which is called the glymphatic system, because it acts like the lymphatic system, which cleans out toxins from your body, but it's carried out by the glia cells of your brain. So it's called the glymphatic system, that clears out toxins from the brain every 24 hours, and it's most active during sleep, and particularly during slow wave sleep. Mm. And so, for example, it's been shown epidemiologically that people who sleep insufficiently are more at risk of Alzheimer's disease and other neurodegenerative diseases. It seems that this is probably because their glymphatic systems aren't getting a chance to clear out the toxins from their brain at night. Other things that are being found are that different sleep disorders may be harbingers of other kinds of neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's. There's a sleep disorder called rapid eye movement sleep behavior disorder, in which people act out their dreams, mm, like those cats of Michel Gervais, they often can injure themselves or their bed partners, sometimes even kill the person they're sleeping with because they're having a nightmare in which they're being attacked and they're fighting back. Well, this sleep disorder seems to be a harbinger for Parkinson's disease and other diseases, related diseases like Lewy body dementia, which are caused by the buildup of a different neurotoxin called alpha-synuclein. And so possibly by looking at this sleep disorder, you might find the biomarkers of early Parkinson's and be able to prevent the disease. Mm-hmm. So there are all sorts of really complex things happening. But another thing that sleep scientists have discovered over the years is that sleep is not just a matter of personal physiology or psychology, that it's a societal issue. And this is something that was really first broached by William Dement, the guy who initially thought that dreams were the safety valve to prevent psychosis. Dement, once he started looking hard at REM sleep and other things, realized, for example, that REM sleep was tied to narcolepsy, that people with narcolepsy had disordered REM sleep that occurred in various disjointed forms throughout the day, and other diseases, sleep apnea and so forth. And he founded the field of sleep medicine in the 1970s to contend with this sort of thing. And as he ran the first modern sleep clinic at Stanford University, he noticed that a lot of people's sleep problems had not only to do with their personal habits and hygiene, but with societal factors like shift work, things like that. One of his students, Mary Carr Skadden, started measuring sleep in children and adolescents and discovered that teenagers have a biological need to go to sleep later and wake up later. And so that if you start high school early in the morning, as we do, high schools generally start earlier than elementary schools, those kids are going to be suffering from health problems, from cognitive problems, from emotional problems. And she started what became a global movement to move back school start times. That's actually starting to affect legislation. Mm. California passed the first law in 2020 mandating that you couldn't start high school or middle school before 8:30 in the morning. Florida recently became the second state to do that. And that's something that's happening all over the world. So the answer is that there are the future of sleep medicine lies not only in these discoveries in the lab, but also in what we do as a society to improve our relationship with sleep.
What we hear a lot about are things like the impact on sleep by caffeine, by screens, by things of that nature. And I'm sure anybody that's listening is wondering these things, like what can I do to just try and have a healthier sleeping life? I mean, maybe you could address a few of those. I know you said that maybe the screens research is inconclusive, but you know, whether it's caffeine, alcohol, any of this stuff, what's kind of some of your short list of recommendations?
I mean, and the funny thing is that although sleep is this amazingly complex phenomenon, the ways to improve sleep for most people actually require just some really simple stuff. And so, for example, keeping a regular schedule is really important because, as scientists have discovered, sleep is coordinated by this biological clock in your brain, the suprachiasmatic nucleus. And if you throw it too many curveballs, it gets confused. And so just trying to go to bed and wake up around the same time every 24 hours is a very important step to take. Another really important thing is exercise, because the brain and the body are intricately tied together, and exercise has neurochemical effects and seems to help keep your circadian clock in sync. Regular exercises, you're not going to sleep better necessarily because you worked out really hard in a single day. It's whether you develop habits that readjust your brain chemistry that way. Another really important thing is light. If you find it hard to go to sleep until late at night, you lie in bed tossing and turning, one way to deal with that is to try to get exposure to bright light in the morning, outdoor light, because indoor light, no matter how bright, unless it's a really special array of super bright lights, is never going to be as bright as outdoor light, even on a cloudy day. So if you get out, take a walk for 10, 20 minutes in the morning, that can help you fall asleep earlier at night. If you're a person who has the opposite problem, you get sleepy too early in the evening, you might want to try taking a walk in sunlight before sunset, because that can help push your clock back a little bit. And if those sort of, and avoid caffeine after certain hours, alcohol, which a lot of people use to try to get to sleep, actually it disturbs your sleep because it changes your body temperature in the middle of the night in ways that you don't want and wakes you up and makes the second half of your sleep more difficult. Abstain from alcohol too close to bedtime. Try not to eat dinner too close to bedtime for obvious reasons. Digestion, can disturb sleep. And if all those things don't work, the first thing to rely on in fixing your problem, if you've got chronic insomnia, is not necessarily sleeping pills. Sleeping pills themselves come with a whole host of potential problems, even though over the years they've become more and more advanced. They've been formulating different types, which are all designed to avoid the pitfalls of the previous generations. They all come with problems of one kind or another if they're used for a prolonged period. the most effective thing you can do without side effects, it seems to be a technique called cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or CBTI, which is a therapeutic approach that combines a whole bunch of different non-pharmacological approaches that have been developed over the years, including cognitive behavioral therapy to change your thought patterns so you're not lying awake ruminating on things that worry you, but also ways to change your conditioning, you know, to use your bed only for sleep and sex and light reading, not for work or watching TV or things like that, because you get associations with the bed that are not sleep associations, and various other techniques. It's a cluster of techniques that seems to work as well or better than pills and won't cause you any of the side effects of those pills. And you can find online ways to get CBTI therapy. It's really very accessible.
Well, I think this is really important because, you know, what I learned a lot when I was training to be a therapist and other things was there was a lot of research coming out that linked mental disorders to sleep disorders. And it was never sure, you know, it was kind of a chicken and egg thing. Did lack of sleep cause depression, or does depression cause lack of sleep? And I'm sure a lot of people are listening and saying, the reason I don't sleep is because my mind is just racing. You know, I wake up with to-do lists, or I'm worried about stuff. So, I mean, maybe just for a minute or two, you could just reflect on the fact that there is this very deep correlation between our mental health and our sleeping patterns. And that's probably something we're still learning a lot about.
We are learning a lot about it. And the term that that experts tend to use for this is bidirectional. The relationship between sleep and psychological issues is bidirectional. So that the more anxiety you have, the worse your sleep is going to tend to be. And the worse your sleep is, the more anxiety you feel while you're awake. And so it's a vicious cycle, and the challenge is to try to break it. One of the problems with existing sleep medications is that they really don't address that. They can try to suppress the anxiety, but often you have to take larger and larger doses of whatever drug it is to have that effect, and eventually it stops working, or those larger doses cause their own psychological and other side effects, which can be really, really harmful. So, and people also turn to things like melatonin, hoping to improve their sleep. Melatonin is a hormone and neurotransmitter, it's sort of a bit of both, that acts in your brain, comes out at night and helps make you sleepy and helps keep you asleep. However, taken in pill form, seems to work for some people, but the formulations that you get at your local health food store are not regulated by any government agency, so they can be really inconsistent, and it also just doesn't work for everybody. And what it doesn't do is interrupt that vicious cycle. I think it's a good idea to attack this at the roots. Sleep problems can also be caused, of course, by physiological problems. They can be caused by chronic pain. And again, it's bidirectional. Sleep problems can be caused by chronic pain. And then the more sleep you lose, the worse your pain becomes during the day. So a key approach in all of these areas is to try to, whatever vicious cycle is interfering with your sleep, try to find a way to intervene and break that cycle.
Well, what's so hard to me about this is that, you know, we already live in an era of anxiety, but now we have thrown all the anxiety, or a lot of it, onto the ways in which we sleep or don't sleep correctly. Like, just the conversation of sleep is one that's filled with anxiety now, right? Everybody says they're not sleeping well enough. Everybody's dealing with this. And it's almost like now the process of going to bed is like a fraught one. It's like, oh my God, what's going to happen tonight? Did I buy the $500 pillow? Is my AC turned down to, you know, 55? You know what I mean? But all of that, because we also have created such a big market around this stuff, and we're marketed sleep stuff as well. It's like the whole thing to me just feels loaded. And we're not going to sleep well because we're thinking about it so much. Do you know what I'm saying? I hope that computes.
It not only does it compute, but there's scientific evidence that is actually completely correct. That one of the factors that keeps people from sleeping is anxiety over how they're going to sleep.
Right.
And part of this is baked into our socioeconomic system, because most of us, except freelancers and unemployed people, are on the clock. And you're thinking that alarm is going to ring tomorrow morning at 5:30, 6:30, 7:00. And how will I feel tomorrow if I don't get to sleep? Oh my God. And that keeps you up.
Yeah.
So that's something that predates any of this sleep technology that we've been swamped with in recent years. There's debate over whether this avalanche of sleep technology is helpful or harmful or neutral. So many of us now are wearing sleep trackers on our wrists or sleep rings or smart pillows or whatever that record, for example, what our respiration and heartbeats were doing throughout the night and how much we moved and things like that. One problem is we really don't know too much about what those small variations signify. And the other thing is that, the question is, what are you going to do about it? If your devices show that you're not sleeping well, what are your interventions? And that's really important. And you don't really need a device to tell you you're not sleeping as well as you might be. What really tells you if you're not sleeping as well as you might be is whether you feel sleepy, irritable, unfocused, during the day, if you wake up from sleep feeling unrefreshed. And the answer to that might not, it could be buying a very expensive pillow, but it might be that you've got something like sleep apnea, yeah, which you don't remember in the morning, and you really need to go to your doctor and find out if that's what's happening. In America, whenever you've got some scientific progress on any kind of medical issue, you're going to have entrepreneurs who are going to find a way to make a buck off of it. That's the society that we live in. But when you're making your personal decisions, I think it's really important to just assess how you're feeling, how you're functioning, and take the simplest possible steps to fix that if there's a problem.
What about just the fact that there's this idea out there that we just don't sleep as much when we're in middle age, or the sleep isn't as deep? I mean, I think anybody here would agree that, they don't sleep the way they did when they were 10 years old as you get a bit older. Is there any research on that? And maybe you can help assuage some of our anxieties around the fact that maybe it's okay not to get 10 hours of sleep every night.
10 hours, one of the interesting pieces of research that's come out in recent years is that too much sleep can also be, it's not clear whether it's dangerous in and of itself or if it's a sign of poor health, but people who sleep for over 8 hours, over 9 hours, 10 hours, tend to be sicker. And also it used to be that people would say, you need your 8 hours a night. Well, most people, it seems, recent studies show that most people actually do fine on 7 or 7.5. It's when you get below 7 statistically, that you start to see higher risk of things like Alzheimer's, cancer, cardiovascular disease, dementia, diabetes, things like that. And those are real statistical trends, which may vary from individual to individual. And yes, there's quite a bit of research showing that our sleep quality and duration tends to get worse as we age. It seems that the system that governs our sleep, like most of our brain and body systems, starts to break down a bit as we get over, into the 50s, 60s, 70s. So one thing that can help with for many of us, of course, is napping. Most older people start to nap during the day. It's not necessarily something they plan, but you drift off while you're reading a book in the late afternoon. And there's some science around napping. Napping can be beneficial, it seems, if you don't do it too much or too late in the day. So if you're going to nap, try to keep it before late afternoon and try to keep it for under 40 minutes seems to be sort of a rough time limit. Because if you do more than that, it reduces your sleep pressure at night. And so it makes it harder to settle in for your night sleep, which again can lead to these vicious circles. But there's science now being done to see if there's ways of artificially enhancing slow wave sleep in people in general and older people in particular by using techniques like transcranial magnetic stimulation or some sort of a low voltage electrical stimulation to certain parts of the brain when slow wave first appears to make it persist and go deeper. That's another interesting thing for the future.
I see a lot of people around me taking things like CBD, for example. Is there any research that CBD could be helpful for sleep?
There is emerging research, but nothing really conclusive yet. CBD, like melatonin, is one of those things that A, seems to work for some people, does not work for a lot of other people, and B, because unlike pharmaceuticals, unlike prescription drugs, the supplements you take, like CBD or melatonin, are not federally controlled. They're not inspected. They're not regulated. And so, in theory, CBD might be helpful. But in reality, when you buy a bottle of those supplements, you don't know if the amount that it says is in each pill is actually the amount that there is. There may be way more. There may be way less. There may be other things in there that are not listed on the label. Again, it's like, if you take it and it works, fine. But it's not a panacea.
Well, it's been so wonderful to be joined by Kenneth Miller. He's the author, most recently, of Mapping the Darkness. Thank you so much for sharing this. It's been a really fascinating tour of the history of sleep. We appreciate the time.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That's it for this week. The producer of Life Examined is Andrea Brody. And now we'd love to hear from you on a topic that really impacts all of us. How do you feel about your quality of sleep? Has it gotten better, worse? What about sleep hygiene? Any tips or tricks you want to share with us? Make sure to chime in on our Facebook group. You can find a link to that at kcrw.com/lifeexamined. There you'll also find a full archive of our shows. And once again, you can reach out to me directly on Instagram. I'm at Jonathan W. Bastian. As always, thanks for joining us on Life Examined right here on your public radio station, KCRW. We'll catch you soon. Have a wonderful day. Take care.